Thus does the vast emporium of words begin to display itself through a catalectic and adhesion via agnate and alumine to animal, answer, and finally to ant. By that last, Murray's team meant a great deal more than simply the small social insect of the Hypenopterus order. There is also the contraction for ain't, a rare prefix meaning anti, as with antacid, and more commonly the suffix derived from the French for sometimes, and appended to make words like tenant, valiant, claimant, and pleasant. 350 pages of scholarly amassment, the first pages of what would, in more than four decades' time, swell to no fewer than 15,487. It was in the new scriptorium in Oxford that Dr. Murray was to do all future work on the dictionary. He and Ada and their considerable family, six sons and five daughters, had moved there in the summer of 1884, 6 months after A to Ant. They had taken a large house on what were then the northern outskirts of the city, at 79 Banbury Road. It was called Sunnyside. The house, large and comfortable in the manner of North Oxford, which is a sedate settling ground for the university's greater dons and lesser institutes, exists still, together with the red pillar box that the post office erected outside to swallow up the immense amounts of outgoing letters. Today the house is occupied by a popular anthropologist, Desmond Morris, and he's changed it little enough on the outside. Only the scriptorium, the scrippy as the Murray family knew it, which Murray's own dictionary defines as the room in a religious house set apart for the copying of manuscripts, has gone. Perhaps not surprisingly, no one, even in Victorian times, much liked the iron and corrugated tin construction, 15 feet by 50, that was put up in the back garden. The next-door neighbour said it spoiled his view, and so Murray had it sunk into a 3-foot-deep trench, which made it damp and cold for the staff, and produced a huge bank of discarded earth that offended the neighbours even more. When it was finished, people said it looked like a tool shed, or a stable, or a wash-house, and those who laboured in it cursed the monkish asceticism of its construction and its irredeemably bone-chilling cold, and called it a horrid, corrugated den. But it was 20 feet longer than the Mill Hill Scriptorium, which does still exist, an annex to the library of what is still a costly and fashionable school, and the arrangements for filing, sorting, and then using the incoming quotation slips, which by now were flooding in at the rate of more than 1,000 each day, were much improved. There were 1,029 pigeonholes built at first. Coleridge, you'll remember, had just 54. Then banks of shelves were built as the volume and the sheer weight of slips became unmanageably large. Long and well-polished mahogany tables supported the texts, selected for the word of the day or the hour, and large churchly lecterns held up the main dictionaries and reference books to which Murray and his men made constant reference. The leader himself had placed his seat and desk on a dais back in the Mill Hill days. Here at Oxford there was a more democratically level floor, but Murray's stool was taller than the rest, and he presided from it still with unchallenged authority, seeing all, missing little. He organized the workings of the scriptorium as might an officer on a battlefield. The slips were the peculiar province of the quartermaster corps, of which Murray was quartermaster general. The packages would come in each morning, 1,000 or so slips a day. One reader would check quickly to see if the quotation was full and all words were spelled properly. Then a second, often one of Murray's children, each of whom was employed almost as soon as he or she was literate, paid 6 pence a week for 30 minutes a day, and rendered precociously crossword capable, would sort the contents of each bundle into the catchwords' alphabetical order. A third worker would then divide the catchwords into their various recognized parts of speech, bell as noun, bell as adjective, bell as verb, for instance, and then a fourth employee would see that the quotations assembled for each were arranged chronologically. Then a sub-editor, one of the more exalted members of the team, would subdivide the meanings of each word into the various shades it had enjoyed over its lifetime. Also at this point, if he had not done so earlier, he'd make a first stab at writing that most crucial feature of most dictionaries, the definition. Defining words properly is a fine and peculiar craft. There are rules, A word, to take a noun as an example, must first be defined according to the class of things to which it belongs, like mammal or quadruped, and then differentiated from other members of that class, as with bovine or female. There must be no words in the definition that are more complicated or less likely to be known than the word being defined. The definition must say what something is and not what it is not. If there's a range of meanings of any one word, cow having a broad range of meaning, cower having essentially only one, then they must be stated. And all the words in the definition must be found elsewhere in the dictionary. A reader must never happen upon a word in the dictionary that he or she cannot discover elsewhere in it. If the definer contrives to follow all these rules, stirs into the mix an ever-pressing need for concision and elegance, and if he or she is true to the task, a proper definition will probably result. By now, the words from the envelope of quotations would have been assembled into the smallest of subgroups, each with a stated meaning and a definition, either just written by a junior or written some time before when the word was in a half-completed state. It simply remained now to divide these groups chronologically, so as to demonstrate, with the army of quotations, just how the shades of meaning of the catchword had altered and evolved over its lifespan. Once this was done, Murray would take the collections of slips for each of the subgroups for any distinct and defined target word and arrange or rearrange or further subdivide them as he saw fit. He would write and insert the word's etymology, which Oxford, despite the existence of its own etymological dictionary, did in the end see fit to allow Murray to include. And its pronunciation, a tricky decision and one likely to provoke, as it has, ceaseless controversy. And then make a final selection of the very best quotations. Ideally, there should be at least one sentence from the literature for each century in which the word was used, unless it was a very fast-changing word that needed more quotations to suggest the speed of its new shadings. Finally, with all that squared away, Murray would write the concise, scholarly, accurate, and lovingly elegant definition for which the dictionary is well known, and send the finished columns over to the press. It would be set in a Clarendon or an old-style typeface, or in Greek or other foreign or Old English or Anglo-Saxon face when needed, and returned to the scriptorium, printed in galley. It was ready to be set onto a page, and the page made into a form for placing on the great letterpress engines in the stone printing works down in the back of Walton Street. Murray was no whiner, but his letters tell a great deal about the difficulty of the task he had set himself, and that the publishers, who wanted to see a return on their investment, in turn had set him. The expressed hope was that two parts, 600 pages of finished dictionary, might be completed each year. Murray himself tried gallantly to complete work on 33 words every day, and yet, often a single word, like approve, he wrote, takes three-quarters of a day itself. Murray spoke of the trials of the work in his presidential address to the Philological Society and a subsequent Athenaeum article in March 1884, an article that led to his first real contact with William Minor. He referred to the difficulty of pushing our way experimentally through an untrodden forest where no white man's axe has been before us. Only those who have made the experiment know the bewilderment with which editor or sub-editor, after he's apportioned the quotations for such a word as above, among 20, 30, or 40 groups, and furnished each of these with a provisional definition, spreads them out on a table or on the floor where he can obtain a general survey of the whole, and spends hour after hour in shifting them about like pieces on a chessboard, striving to find in the fragmentary evidence of an incomplete historical record such a sequence of meanings as may form a logical chain of development. Sometimes the quest seems hopeless. Recently, for example, the word art utterly baffled me for several days. Something had to be done with it. Something was done and put in type, but the renewed consideration of it in print, with the greater facility of reading and comparison which this afforded, led to the entire pulling to pieces and reconstruction of the edifice extending to several columns of type. It was at about this time, when Murray was so very vexed over art, that one of his sub-editors, or perhaps it was Murray himself, wrote the first official request to Broadmoor. They wanted Dr. Minor to find out if he had earmarked any quotations for art that suggested other meanings or which came from earlier dates than had been assembled so far. 16 distinct shades of meaning had been uncovered for the noun. Perhaps Minor had some more, or some further illumination of the word. If so, then he, and anyone else for that matter, should kindly send them back to Oxford, post-haste. 18 letters duly came in about the word from a variety of readers who had seen the article. One of the replies, undeniably the most fruitful, came from Broadmoor. In comparison with all other readers who had offered merely one sentence or two, the unsung Dr. Minor had enclosed no fewer than 27. He struck his sub-editors in Oxford as not only a meticulous man, he was also very prolific and able to tap deep into wells of knowledge and research. The dictionary team had made a rare find. It has to be said that most of Minor's quotations for this particular word came from a somewhat obvious source. Sir Joshua Reynolds's famous Discourses, written in 1769, the year after he became president of the Royal Academy. But they were of inestimable value to the dictionary makers, and as proof, there today, standing as a mute memorial to the beginnings of his work, is the first known quotation that William Chester Minor had placed in the finished book. It is the second quotation under the sense "the arts," and it reads simply, 1769 Reynolds, Sir J. Disc. 1. Works, 1870, page 306. There is a general desire among our nobility to be distinguished as lovers and judges of the arts. Unwittingly, Sir Joshua's words were to provide the starting point for a relationship between Dr. Murray and Dr. Minor that would combine sublime scholarship, fierce tragedy, Victorian reserve, deep gratitude, mutual respect, and a slowly growing amity that could even, in the loosest sense, be termed friendship. Whatever it was called, it was a link that would last the two men until death finally separated them 30 years later. The work Dr. Minor did for the dictionary, and which began with Reynolds's Discourses, continued for the next 2 decades. But some stronger bond than a simple love of words had also been forged, and it was one that kept these two so different elderly men intimately connected for half as long again. It was to be 7 years before they met, however. During that time, Minor began to send out his quotations at a prodigious rate, at times many more than 100 new slips every week, as many as 20 a day, all in a neat, firm hand. He would write to Murray, always rather formally, straying only rarely into matters that were not within his self-appointed purview. The first correspondence that survives from October 1886 was largely about agricultural matters. Perhaps the doctor, taking a break from his work at the table, had stood up to stretch and had gazed wistfully from his cell window down at the farm labourers in the valley below, watching them stacking the late autumn sheaves and drinking warm cider under the oaks. He refers in his letter to a book he's reading called The Country Farm by Gervase Markham, published in 1616, and to occurrences of the verb bell, as when the ripening hops swell out in bell shapes in late August. Blight, too, catches his attention, as well as blast and then heckling, which on farms once meant the process of separating the individual stems of the flax plant from each other, and only later became used, often in a political context, in the sense of catechizing someone, making his or her arguments stand up to severe scrutiny, as a flax plant might stand when divided for the scutcher. He likes the word buckwheat, too, and its French translation, blé noir, and finds such niceties as ointment of buckwheat. He clearly revels in his work. One can almost feel him squirming with something akin to teenage excitement as he offers, "I could give you more if you wanted," and as a teasing bonus throws in a small temptation on the thoroughly amusing word horsebred. He signs off, seeming to will a response from the great man on the great outside, "I trust same may be useful to you. Very truly yours, W.C. Minor, Broadmoor, Crowthorne, Berkshire." The tone of this and other such letters as survive seems halfway between the obsequious and the detached, dignified and controlled on the one hand, and leavened with Uriah Heep-like toadying on the other. Minor wants desperately to know that he's being helpful. He wants to feel involved. He wants, but knows he can never demand, that praise be showered on him. He wants respectability, and he wants those in the asylum to know that he is special, different from others in their cells. Though he has no idea at all of his correspondent's character or circumstances, thinking him still a practising medical man of literary tastes with a good deal of leisure, Murray seems to recognise something of his pleading tone. He notices, for instance, the curious way Minor seems to prefer to work on those words that are current, like art first and then blast and buckwheat, and that are in the process of being placed into the succession of pages, parts, and volumes of the moment. Murray notes in a letter to a colleague that Minor clearly very much wants to stay up to date, that unlike most other readers, he's no interest in working on words that are destined for volumes and letters to be published years and decades hence. The editor writes later that he feels Minor clearly wants to be able to feel involved, to enjoy the impression that he, Minor, is somehow a part of the team, doing things in tandem with the scribes up at the scriptorium. Minor was none too far from Oxford, after all. Perhaps he felt as though he were at a detached college like St. Catherine's Society or Mansfield Hall, and that his cells, or what James Murray still thought of as his comfortable, book-lined brown study, were just a rurally detached edition of the scriptorium, a den of scholarly creation and lexical detective work. Had anyone chosen to ponder further, he or she might have wondered at the strange symmetry of the two men's settings, pinioned as each was among great stacks of books, single-mindedly devoted to learning of the most recondite kind, each man's only outlet, his correspondence, in great daily storms of paper and floods of ink. Except there was a difference. William Minor remained profoundly and irreversibly mad. The Broadmoor attendants had noticed some improvement in the very early 1880s, when he first replied to the appeal from Mill Hill. But as the years went on, and as Minor passed dejected and alone through the milestone of his 50th birthday in June 1884, his elderly stepmother having visited him the month before, on her way home to the United States from Ceylon, where she had stayed since her husband's death, so the old ills returned, reinvigorated, reinforced. "Dear Dr. Orange," he writes to the Broadmoor superintendent at the beginning of the next September, "the defacement of my books still goes on. It's simply certain that someone besides myself has access to them and abuses it." His handwriting now is shaky, uncertain. He heard his cell door opening at 3 a.m. the night before, he says, and he goes on raving, "The sound of that door, as you may verify since the alteration, is unmistakable, and you could be as morally sure of its closure by the sound as of anything you do not really see." If he has no other remedy, he warns, "I shall have to send my books back to London and have them sold." Thankfully, this small tantrum was short-lived. Had it continued or worsened, the dictionary might have lost one of its closest and most valuable friends. A month later, a new obsession grips him. "Dear Dr. Orange, let me mention one fact that falls in with my hypothesis. So many fires have occurred in the U.S. originating quite inexplicably in the interspace of ceiling and floor that, I learn now, insurance companies refuse to insure large buildings, mills, factories, which have the usual hollow spacing under the floor. They insist upon solid floors. All this has come to notice within 10 years, but no one suggests any explanation." Except Dr. Minor, that is. Fiends have been creeping about in the interstices between floors and ceilings, and have wrought mischief and committed crimes, not least in Broadmoor, where they hide and crawl out at night to abuse the poor doctor nightly, to mark his books, steal his flute, and torture him cruelly. The hospital, he says, must now have solid floors built in, otherwise no fire insurance, and a host of nightly misdeeds. The daily reports flow in a kind of seamless syrup of insanity. 4 cakes stolen, his flute gone, his books all marked, he himself frog-marched up and down the corridor by attendants James and Annette. A spare key used at night to allow villagers into his rooms to abuse him and his possessions. Dr. Minor in his drawers and shirt, stockings and slippers, complaining that small pieces of wood were forced into his lock, that electricity was used on his body, that a murderous lot had beaten him during the night and had left a savage pain all along his left side. Scoundrels came to his room. Attendant Coles came at 6 a.m. and used my body. "It is a very dirty business," he screamed one morning, standing now only in his drawers, "that a fellow cannot sleep without Coles coming in like that." Again, and as before, he made a pimp of me. And yet, as came the madness, so came the words. Many of those that fascinated him were Anglo-Indian, reflecting his birthplace. There were Bhang, Brinjal, Catamaran, Cholera, Chunam, Kutchery. He liked brick tea. By the time of the middle 1890s, he became very active working on the letter D, and though there are some Hindustani words like Dubash, Dubba, and Dobi, he was interested also in what were regarded as the core words of the dictionary, and contributions of quotations are in the Oxford archives for such words as delicately, directly, dirt, disquiet, drink, duty, and die. He was able more often than not to supply the quotation for the first use of a word, always an occasion for celebration. For the use of the word dirt in the meaning earth, he quotes from John Fryer's New Account of East Indies and Persia, published in 1698, for one meaning of magnificence, for one of model, for reminiscence, and for spalt, meaning a foolish person, the first work by Dubosc also provided ideal material. The dictionary staff at Oxford noticed only one small and strange rhythm to miners' otherwise frantic pace, that in the high summertime rather fewer packages would come. Perhaps, they speculated innocently, Dr. Miner liked to spend the warm days outside, away from his books, a reasonable explanation indeed. But when the autumn came around again, and the evening began to darken, so he began working ceaselessly once more, replying to every request, asking repeatedly and anxiously about the progress of the work, inundating the team with ever more packages of slips, more quotations even than were needed. "One could wish that Dr. Miner had made about half the number of references," wrote Murray to another editor, overwhelmed. "But indeed one really never knows what words will come of use till one comes to deal with the word lexicographically." Because his method of working was very different from everyone else's, it is more difficult to make a quantitative comparison to set the numerical achievement of his work against that of other great contributors. Perhaps at the end of the project he had actually sent in no more than 10,000 slips, which sounds a fairly modest number. But as virtually all of them proved to be useful, and because every one of them was wanted and had been ordered, so his achievement as a contributor more than equals the effort achieved by some others in sending in 10,000 slips a year. The Oxford team was indeed grateful. The preface to the first completed volume, Volume 1, A to B, when finished in 1888, a full 9 years after the project was begun, contains a one-line mention. It might as well have been a page of fulsome thanks, and it made their contributors supremely proud, not least because it was, by happenstance, discreet enough to offer no hint to others of his strange situation. It said simply and elegantly, "Dr. W. C. Miner of Crowthorne." Grateful though they might have been, the Oxford team was also becoming, as time went on, very, very puzzled. And Murray was more puzzled than all of them. For who exactly was this brilliant, strange, exacting man, they asked one another. Murray attempted fruitlessly to inquire. Crowthorne was less than 40 miles from Oxford, an hour by the Great Western Railway via Reading. How was it that Miner, so distinguished and energetic a man, and so much a neighbour, was never to be seen? How could there be a man of such lexicographical skills, who had so much leisure and energy and lived so very close, and who yet never seemed to want to see the temple to which he sent so many thousands of offerings? Where was the man's curiosity? What was his pleasure? Was he somehow unwell, disabled, frightened? Could it be that he felt intimidated by the company of great Oxford men like these? The answer to the deepening mystery came about in a curious manner. It was delivered to Dr. Murray by a passing scholar-librarian who stopped by at the scriptorium in 1889 to talk about more serious matters. In the course of a talk that ranged across the entire spectrum of lexicography, he made a chance reference to the Crowthorne doctor. "How kind the good James Murray had evidently been to him," remarked the scholar. "How good you have been to our poor Dr. Miner." There was a startling pause, and the sub-editors and secretaries in the scriptorium, who had overheard the conversation, suddenly stopped in their tracks. As one, they looked up toward where the leader and his visitor were sitting. "Poor Dr. Miner," asked Murray, as perplexed as any one of those who were now keenly listening. "What can you possibly mean?" The Meeting of Minds. Denouement. Noun. unravelling, specifically the final unravelling of the complications of a plot in a drama, a novel, etc., the catastrophe, and transferably, the final solution or issue of a complication, difficulty, or mystery. Modern literary myth maintains even today that the strangest puzzle surrounding William Chester Minor's career was this. Just why did he not attend the great dictionary dinner, a dinner to which he was invited, held in Oxford on the glittering evening of Tuesday, October the 12th, 1897? It was Queen Victoria's Jubilee year, and those who were connected with the OED project were in more than a mood for a party. The dictionary was at long last going well. The faltering progress of the early years was now accelerating. The farcical Anter to Battening had been published in 1885, Battently to Bosom in 1887, Bra to Bison in 1888. A new spirit of efficiency had settled on the scriptorium, and as crowning glory, Queen Victoria herself had in 1896 graciously agreed, as the court liked to say, that the just-completed Volume 3, embracing the entirety of the infuriating letter C, which the lexicographers found unusually filled with ambiguities and complexities, not least because of its frequent overlaps with the letters G, K, and S, should be dedicated to her. An aura of majestic permanence had all of a sudden invested the dictionary. There was no doubt now that it would eventually be completed, for since it had been royally approved, who could ever brook its cancellation? With that happy realization, and with the Queen having done her part, so Oxford, in high mood for celebration, decided it could follow suit. James Murray deserved to be given honours and thanks, and who more appropriate than the great man's adopted university to bestow them? The university's new vice-chancellor decided that a big dinner, slap-up, to employ a phrase that the dictionary was to quote from 1823, should be held in Murray's honour. It would be staged in the huge hall at the Queen's College, where by old tradition a scholar with a silver trumpet sounds a fanfare to summon guests in to dine. It would celebrate what the Times, on the day of the dinner, proclaimed to be the greatest effort probably which any university, it may be any printing press, has taken in hand since the invention of printing. It will not be the least of the glories of the University of Oxford to have completed this gigantic task. The evening would be a memorable Oxford event. And indeed it was. The long tables were splendidly decorated with flowers and with all the best silverware and crystal that Queen's could roust from its cellars. The menu was forthright and English, clear turtle soup, turbot with lobster sauce, haunch of mutton, roast partridges, Queen Mab pudding, and strawberry ice. But like the dictionary itself, it was also flavoured generously, but not too generously, with Gallicisms, sweetbreads after the mode of Villeroy, grenadines of veal, ramekins. The wines were plentiful and excellent, an 1858 Amontillado sherry, an 1882 Adriatic Maraschino liqueur, an aged Chateau d'Yquem, and champagne by Funkst, 1889. The guests wore white tie, academic robes, medals. During the speeches, and after a loyal toast in which the graciousness of Her Majesty was duly noted and her 6 decades on the throne proudly congratulated, they smoked cigars. They must have smoked long and well. There were no fewer than 14 speeches. James Murray on the entire history of dictionary making, the head of the Oxford University Press on his belief that the project was a great duty to the nation, and the egregious Frederick Furnival, as lively and amusing as ever, taking time from recruiting buxom Amazons from the local ABC tea house to come a-rowing with him to speak on what he saw as Oxford's heartless attitude towards the omission of women. Among the guests could be counted all the great and the good of the academic land, the editors of the dictionary, the delegates of the press, the printers, members of the Philological Society, and not least some of the most assiduous and energetic of the volunteer readers. There was, for instance, Mr. F. T. Elworthy of Wellington, Miss J. E. A. Brown of Further Barton near Cirencester, the Reverend W. E. Smith of Putney, Lord Aldenham, better known by friends of the dictionary as Mr. H. Huck Gibbs, Mr. Russell Martineau, Monsieur F. J. Amour, and for the later parts of D, the Mrs. Edith and E. Perrinett Thompson, both of Reigate. The list was long, but so sonorous were the names and so evidently awesome their achievements, the diners, well into their port and cognac by now, heard them out in a silence that was easy to confuse with rapture. As it happens, the most generous remarks made about the volunteers that night relate to two men who had much in common. Both were Americans, both spent time in India, both were soldiers, both were mad, and though both had been invited, neither one came to the Oxford dinner. The first was Dr. FitzEdward Hall, who came from Troy, New York. His was a bizarre story. Just as he was about to enter Harvard in 1848, his family demanded that he set off for Calcutta to track down an errant brother. His own ship was wrecked in the Bay of Bengal. He survived and became fascinated by Sanskrit, studying it to the point where he was eventually offered the chair in Sanskrit at Government College in Varanasi, then called Benares, the holiest city in the Ganges Valley. He fought for the British side during the Sepoy Mutiny of 1857 as a rifleman. Then he left India in 1860 and became Sanskrit professor at King's College London and librarian at the India office. And then, quite precipitously, his life fell terribly apart. No one is sure why, except that he had a furious dispute with a fellow Sanskrit scholar from Austria named Theodor Gollstucker. It was a dispute of such gravity, linguists and philologists were known to be mercurial and to hold eternal grudges, that it caused Hall to quit the India office, to have himself summarily suspended from the Philological Society, and to leave London for a small village in Suffolk. People said he was a drunkard, a foreign spy, hopelessly immoral, an academic phony. He, in turn, accused all Britons of turning on him, ruining his life, driving away his wife, and displaying only a fiendish hatred, as he put it, of Americans. He turned the key in the lock of his cottage in Marlsford, and, except for the occasional steamer voyage back home to New York, lived the life of a near-total country recluse. And yet he wrote every single day to James Murray at Oxford, a correspondence that continued for 20 years. The two men never met, but over the years Hall, without complaint, compiled slips, answered queries, offered advice, and remained the staunchest ally of the dictionary during its bleakest days. Small wonder that Dr. Murray wrote in the great preface, "Above all, we have to record the inestimable collaboration of Dr. FitzEdward Hall, whose voluntary labours have completed the literary and documentary history of numberless words, senses, and idioms, and whose contributions are to be found on every page." Those at the dinner knew why he had not come. They knew that he was a hermit, that he was difficult. But no one knew, or so the story has long had it, exactly why the man next mentioned had not turned up. Murray, in writing the celebrated preface, had been almost equally generous in his praise. "Also," he said, "the unflagging services of Dr. W. C. Minor, which have week by week supplied additional quotations for the words actually preparing for the press. Second only to the contributions of Dr. FitzEdward Hall," Murray was to write a little later, "in enhancing our illustration of the literary history of individual words, phrases, and constructions, have been those of Dr. W. C. Minor, received week by week." But where, wondered the gathered assembly, was Dr. Minor? He was living at Crowthorne, only 60 minutes away by the green and gold steam trains of the Great Western. He was not notorious as an ill-tempered misanthrope like Dr. Hall. His letters had always been noted for their polite solicitousness, so why could he not have had the courtesy to come? To some who dined at Queen's on that glorious autumn evening, Minor's absence must have seemed a melancholy footnote to an otherwise glorious literary moment.